Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with the recently appointed physician-in-chief of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Dr. Jose Baselga, and to begin, we discussed his landmark research on the anti-HER2 dimerization antibody that is now approved for practice.
Pertuzumab is an antibody against HER2 that is different in many ways to trastuzumab. It does bind to HER2, the same as trastuzumab, but it binds at a different site in the extracellular domain. And what it does, it prevents binding of HER3 with HER2, which we now know is very important. So it is attacking, if you wish, a different mechanism of HER2 activation. What we have learned over the last 2 years is that pertuzumab, when given in combination with trastuzumab, is far better than trastuzumab alone. We're always talking with chemotherapy, so that's in. And what has been a practice-changing trial was the Cleopatra trial, and that's a trial that we did in the first-line setting. That was a large phase 3 study, and patients with advanced HER2-positive disease were randomized to receive trastuzumab plus docetaxel versus trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and docetaxel. And there, what we observed was a very significant improvement, not only in progression-free survival, but also in survival as well. It's quite remarkable.
And I'd like to kind of dissect out a little bit about what that means in terms of practice. But just going back to the mechanisms, I'm just kind of curious. First, I'm curious if you were surprised by the magnitude of benefit, because I was, frankly. I was kind of skeptical it was even going to help.
Well, I was not surprised because I had been developing pertuzumab from the beginning, and I was kind of pushing. There was a moment in which it was almost dead, its development, and I really kept pushing. I was convinced that pertuzumab was going to be a very useful agent when we were doing the phase 2 study with no chemotherapy. And what we did in that study is that we had patients that had failed trastuzumab. These patients had advanced disease, and the last therapy they had received was trastuzumab-based. And then they progressed, so they were trastuzumab failures. And in that study, that's a small study that was published in JCO, but people not that familiar with it, we just added pertuzumab to trastuzumab-failing patients. And what we observed in that study was a clinical benefit rate of 50%. And a 25% response rate. When I saw that, I was convinced this is a big drug. And the beauty of that study also is that we had a cohort of patients that were treated only with pertuzumab. So the same patient population, only with pertuzumab. And response rate was very minimal, was 7%. And yet, those patients that had failed pertuzumab, we then went on as part of the study, and we added trastuzumab. And we also had a 20% response rate. So to me, that was a very clear indication that pertuzumab together with trastuzumab, the two, the power of dual blockade, was going to be an important contribution in breast cancer.
I've asked quite a few people over the years, including your now colleague, Cliff Huddis, about how trastuzumab works to start with. What's your vision of how trastuzumab works and why pertuzumab adds so much to it?
Right. So trastuzumab has at least three well-defined mechanisms of action. The first one, and in my mind perhaps the most important, is that trastuzumab prevents ligand-independent HER2 receptor activation. So if you have a lot of HER2 in a tumor, these receptors do not need a ligand to talk to each other and to form homodimers. And when homodimers, that is, when two molecules of HER2 get together, they activate the tyrosine kinase. Trastuzumab is very, very efficacious in preventing activation of the receptor in this way. So it's what we called ligand-independent receptor activation. That's trastuzumab. Now, on top of this, trastuzumab also has the capacity to induce an immune response against the tumor. So what we call antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity. So you have the NK cells that are around the tumor, and they have the capacity to bind to the Fc fragment of the antibody, and that basically puts together the NK cell with the HER2-positive cancer cell, and that results in an anti-tumor effect. That's the second mechanism. The third one, which I think it's also important, is that trastuzumab, by binding to HER2, the complex of the antibody and the receptor becomes internalized. So there is a downregulation of HER2 levels in the cell surface, if you wish, and therefore HER2 is less potent because you have less receptors. These are the three well-defined mechanisms of actions of trastuzumab. Pertuzumab is another beast. We know that as important of HER2 homodimers, as important as that, is the formation of HER3, that's another receptor that has a high degree of homology to HER2. So HER3, that's the receptor where the ligand binds to. So HER-regulin, neregulin, all the ligands that are known to be HER2 ligands, those ligands don't bind to HER2. They cannot bind to HER2. They don't have a binding site. So what they do is that they bind to HER3, and then upon HER3 binding, HER3 changes its conformation and then approaches HER2, and they form dimers. These are HER2, HER3 heterodimers. This combination is the most potent combination of all. The HER2, HER3 heterodimers is the most potent signaling receptor duet, if you wish, that we have in breast cancer. That's what pertuzumab inactivates. So pertuzumab gets there and prevents that binding from occurring.
Before we go on with pertuzumab, I'm going to just interject one thought I had as you were describing what we think about in terms of these mechanisms, which is, you know, I just had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Norman Wallmark from the NSABP, and we were chatting about their trial looking at trastuzumab and HER2 negative, or certainly FISH negative tumors. What do you think about that phenomenon? Can you envision the possibility that anti-HER therapy or trastuzumab could benefit people without HER2 overexpression?
Well, I could be totally wrong here, but I have a strong view. I think trastuzumab does not work in low HER2 expressors. We need to keep in mind that the NSABP study that showed that there was some benefit with trastuzumab in low HER2 expressors, those tumors at some point by somebody had been scored as HER2 positive. So this was the process of the SUMPAC data. That was the result of a central review. But again, some point somewhere, those tumors were called HER2 positive. In the lab, you do not benefit from trastuzumab unless you have a lot of HER2 overexpression. So I think that trastuzumab is not going to work in low HER2 overexpressors.
It kind of related, again, I was talking to Dr. Matt Ellis about this phenomenon of HER2 mutations, and I think they've seen that in lung cancer. But, of course, I don't think we know right now how these patients with these HER2 mutations will respond to treatment unless you do. But could that be a mechanism where somebody might not have overexpression but might respond?
Correct. So these mutations are real. They are not frequent, but they are real. There are several of them in multiple sites of the receptor. They activate the receptor, there is no question. Trastuzumab is not going to work there either. What's going to work there, and this data from Matt Ellis that he published in Cancer Discovery, this data from our own lab, the small kinase inhibitors are going to work. So we are very excited. There is one compound called neratinib. And we are doing what we call a basket study. That's a new thing. So basically, the basket study is that we are taking anybody with one of these mutations, and we don't care if this is a lung cancer patient or a breast cancer patient or colon, doesn't matter. And we are going to be testing them with neratinib. And our prediction is that these patients will respond to these small kinase inhibitors.
Again, another one of your newer colleagues, Dr. Mark Chris, has been talking to me about this also in lung cancer, so that would be interesting. Is there some reason to think neratinib would be more effective than lapatinib?
Lapatinib will be effective. I think you will see patients responding with it. In the laboratory, neratinib appears to be more potent against these mutations.
So going back to pertuzumab in terms of some of the practical issues, first, in terms of what it's combined with, at this point, seems like docetaxel, paclitaxel, I think usually can be accessed. How do you approach that? And just sort of, you know, theoretically, would you expect that, you know, any kind of chemotherapy theoretically would benefit by adding pertuzumab to trastuzumab?
Yeah, that's a very important question. So the data we have right now, it's only with taxanes, right? So I think that's what should be using. If I were to speculate, I cannot imagine this not working, you know, with the different chemotherapies, because in a way, this is not about the chemotherapy. This is about enhancing the anti-HER2 effect. So I believe that this is likely to be chemotherapy neutral, if you wish. And what we are doing is that we are empowering the anti-HER2 effect with a combination that, by the way, is extremely, extremely well tolerated. We need to realize that there is very minimal, if any, additional side effects by adding pertuzumab to trastuzumab.
Just to follow up that last point, I did see a paper, amazingly, a meta-analysis of dermatologic toxicity with pertuzumab, which is something I hadn't kind of heard about from people who use the drugs. Is this a practical issue?
In practical terms, I don't think that's an issue. We do see some rash in some patients, and we also see in some patients a little bit of increase in the bowel movement frequency. So there's a little bit of, in some situations, mild diarrhea. But we're talking about a very minimal side effects. For practical purposes, I don't recall having had to dose reduce any patient because of rash or diarrhea. So it's different from some of the other rashes that we might see.
Another practical question is using it in second line and beyond. What information do we have about it and what you're feeling in terms of efficacy as you move down the line?
Right. So the data that is out there in second line is our phase two study that was published, has been published twice in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. So in second line, without chemotherapy, in patients that have progressed on trastuzumab, the combination of trastuzumab and pertuzumab gives us a clinical benefit rate of 50% and gives us a response rate in the range of 25% with very minimal toxicity and a progression of around 8 to 9 months. So I do think it's a real option. And one can even theoretically question whether we should ever again just do single HER2 blockade from now on, or whether we should just be considering, in particular in those responding patients, in these patients that have shown exquisite sensitivity to dual HER2 blockade, one can even conceptually propose that dual HER2 blockade is going to be efficient across the disease spectrum, first line, second line, and beyond.
So does that mean that maybe we're moving towards, I mean, certainly the culture of management of metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer has shifted towards anti-HER therapy indefinitely. I've had a lot of questions from people about the thought about the continuation of pertuzumab and trastuzumab on progression.
Right. So that's a critical question. We are doing precisely the clinical trial to address this question, and that we would only know with the clinical trial results. But conceptually, I could not see why would not that be the case. Either trastuzumab and pertuzumab or some form of dual HER2 blockade. We know that the blockade of HER2 induced by trastuzumab is incomplete and suboptimal. And therefore, I think that either we have to add pertuzumab to the picture or we need to add a TKI such as lapatinib or neratinib in order to have optimal HER2 blockade. And you know, HER2 dependency is a condition for life in these tumors. It's not like ER-positive tumors that at some point may become ER-independent. HER2 is a too-dominant an oncogene. And those tumors, even if they acquire additional mechanisms of resistance, and they will, they continue to have a very important dependence on HER2.
I want to start to bring T-DM1 into this discussion, but one more question about pertuzumab relating to its potential use in the adjuvant setting. We have the AFFINITY trial out there. Any predictions or thoughts about how this is going to play out in the adjuvant setting and when we might get some answers?
Right. So, as you might know, I'm the principal investigator of AFFINITY together with Gunther von Migwix. So this is a worldwide study The study is enrolling very well, but it will take a while to get us some data. At least it's going to be a couple of years, I think, until we get some. I cannot imagine the study not being positive. In the history of breast oncology, and in particular in the history of HER2-positive disease, every single time we had a disease that in the first-line setting has resulted in a marked improvement in survival, we have then seen benefit in the adjuvant setting. So the improvement in survival is so obvious in the first-line setting that I think in the adjuvant disease, if any, will be magnified.
So, and of course, now we also have a lot more neoadjuvant data. We certainly seen the NeoSphere study. And one of the things I was curious about there is, you know, there were a fraction of people there who got just the two antibodies, pertuzumab and trastuzumab, and they did see path CRs, I think, in the range of 17-18%. Any thoughts, you know, as you talked about the mechanisms of what's going on, of the kind of a tumor profile that would be exquisitely sensitive to this with that chemo?
Right. So that's a very good point. And that's the direction that we are taking. And if you just think about this for a second, it's remarkable. This is the most aggressive tumor type that we had 10 years ago. And here we are, you and me, discussing whether we can treat these tumors without chemotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting, just to see how much the change has occurred. I think we will identify a patient population that does not need chemotherapy. For example, we know from the NeoSphere data set, and most importantly from the Cleopatra data set, that tumors harboring PI3 kinase mutations respond less. PI3 kinase is downstream of HER2, and if the gene is mutant, these tumors are probably less sensitive to inhibition of HER2 upstream. Well, we know that's one factor. We know that higher levels of HER2 correlate with greater benefit. That's from the biomarker study in Cleopatra. We know also that higher levels of HER3 correlate with better outcome.
And when you say higher levels of HER2, you mean FISH amplification?
No, we're looking by a PCR-based assay. And all this is purely experimental, but we did a PCR-based assay. But we showed that very convincingly. So I am convinced, and I'm an optimistic, but I'm convinced that we will develop a signature of HER2 dependency. And also, you know, we could be creative about clinical trial design. So, for example, we could go in and we could propose dual pertuzumab, trastuzumab therapy in the neoadjuvant setting and then see what happens and see who obtains a pathological complete remission. Those patients that achieve a pathological complete remission, they're probably likely going to be cured. So maybe those patients don't need additional therapy. And then on the other hand, those that do not achieve a PCR would be those patients in which then you would go in with chemotherapy in the post-surgical space. So, you know, even the response of a given patient down the line could help you identify whom to recommend chemotherapy.
Although, you know, it's been, at least from the outside looking in, asking people about it, you kind of really don't get too much of a response when you talk about biomarkers that predict response in anti-HER therapy. You had your presentation about Cleopatra. There had been, at San Antonio, there had been previous work out of the NeoSphere study. And I kind of didn't really get the feeling there was something dominant that's coming out of all this.
PI3 kinase. That's a very dominant. It's very, very clear. So if we look at the Cleopatra study, PI3 kinase is a major prognostic indicator of response to anti-HER2 therapies.
And I know PI3 kinase was a big topic at San Antonio, and probably most of it was going over my head. Are you talking about mutations mainly?
I am talking, right. So I'm talking mostly about mutations of PI3 kinase, which are very frequent in HER2-positive breast cancer. So about a quarter of HER2-positive breast cancer have mutations.
And in terms of trying to, you know, have an impact in these types of tumors in general, not just HER2-positive disease, where do mTOR inhibitors fit in, and where do specific PI3 kinase inhibitors fit in, and what's the difference?
Right. So there are three ways to tackle the PI3 kinase pathway in breast cancer. One is with mTOR inhibitors. mTOR is downstream of PI3 kinase and AKT. So you have PI3 kinase, then from there you go to AKT, and from there you go to mTOR. So mTOR inhibitors, that's one way. Then you have the second class of compounds are the pan PI3 kinase inhibitors. PI3 kinase has four subunits, and we have compounds in clinical development. They block all these subunits.
TKIs?
They are TKIs, and they inhibit. So the ones in clinical development are BKM-120 and then GDZ-941, just to give you a flavor of those. And then there's a third class of compounds that are just inhibiting the subunit that is mutant in breast cancer. That's the alpha subunit, and we call them the PI3 kinase alpha inhibitors. They are very specific against this subunit. Well, we have reported in the phase 1 setting a very high response rate in patients with metastatic disease upon therapy with these alpha-specific PI3 kinase inhibitors. We are talking of response rates far greater than with mTOR inhibitors. So the way forward, what we're going to do is we are going to be identifying upfront those patients that harbor PI3 kinase mutations. And these are the patients that down the line are going to be offered therapy with these PI3 kinase alpha inhibitors. These compounds are moving very fast in clinical development. We're going to start a bunch of neoadjuvant studies with them. We're going to start also soon a very ambitious phase 2 and phase 3 program. So I think to me, that's one of the next big exciting targets in breast cancer. And it's so related to HER2 in many ways.
How frequently is this mutation seen both with HER2 positive and HER2 negative breast cancer?
Right. So PI3 kinase mutations are seen in 25% of HER2 positive breast tumors and in 40% of ER positive HER2 negative tumors. So very, very high prevalence in the ER positive subgroup. In triple negatives, they are less frequent. So you only have an 8% mutation.
So we'll get back to TDM1 at some point, but as long as we're sort of moving in this direction, particularly since I'm starting to understand stuff I haven't understood before, I noticed a really fascinating paper and a cool editorial by Alan Ashworth that went with it, that you were involved with a study in triple negative breast cancer, which you were just talking about, in terms of using a PI3 kinase inhibitor plus a PARP inhibitor. I thought that was pretty cool. What's that all about?
Yeah, so as part of the Stand Up to Cancer initiative, there were a number of investigators, Luke Conley on one side and my lab on the other, that we began to take a global view at PI3 kinase in breast cancer. And we identified all papers that linked PI3 kinase inhibition with loss of DNA repair. So PI3 kinase in triple-negative breast cancer is required for DNA repair to be active. So you have a tumor that needs a lot of repair because it has a lot of genomic instability. You know, it's like having your Ferrari in the shop all the time. So a lot of repair needs to take on. And in these triple-negative breast cancers, PI3 kinase regulates the repair of DNA. So it occurred to us to, and we did that independently, but we had the same data, fascinating. It occurred to us that if we would inhibit PI3 kinase, we would induce DNA damage. And that's exactly what we did. So in our case, that's a paper that we just published in Cancer Discovery. We had the opportunity to take tumors from patients that were triple negative, and we derived primary xenografts in nude mice. So these are cell lines that go straight from the patient to the mice. And then we began to treat them with PI3 kinase inhibitors, and we saw massive increase in DNA damage. And then we began to look for mechanisms. And to make a long story short, we identified that PI3 kinase inhibition results in a marked decrease in the levels of BRCA1 and BRCA2. So PI3 kinase controls the synthesis, if you wish, of BRCA1 and 2. And if you block PI3 kinase, you have a state that has a resemblance to BRCA1 and 2 deficient tumors because, you know, the gene is functional, but the protein levels go down a lot. So that was like the aha moment of this project and said, well, if these inhibitors render the cells BRCA deficient, what we ought to do here is to put them together, the PARP inhibitors and the PI3 kinase. And when we did that, I mean, we could not believe what we were seeing. Tumors that were very aggressive now are melting away.
In the Petri dish? Or?
No, in mice.
In mice?
Yes, and in multiple models. And Lou Conley had the same findings. Our papers were back to back.
Right.
And what we've done now is that we are doing a clinical trial as part of the Standard to Cancer, combining olaparib, which is one of the PARP inhibitors, with BKM-120, which is one of the pan-PI3 kinase inhibitors. So we're terribly excited about this.
This is going to be just triple negative?
Yes.
And just triple negative with overexpression, with a mutation,
no.
Or just
no.
Any triple negative?
No. Any triple negative.
Has the trial actually started?
Yes.
How many patients have been treated?
It's a few patients yet, so I don't know, less than 20. But I've been told that, I'm not doing this myself, but I've been told that they're seeing some very nice data already, so it looks very good.
Wow. Be great to see that get started. You know, we were talking about triple negative all the time a few years ago,
yeah.
And then once the Inipirib thing crashed, like it seemed like nobody was interested anymore.
Yeah.
But it's still out there.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about T-DM1, certainly a very critical, practical issue now since it's just, thank goodness, approved. Amazingly, two agents in the same year for HER2-positive.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the work that's been done with this agent, what it is, and where you see it fitting in right now and in the future?
Right. So T-DM1 is very appealing for multiple reasons. It's a new concept, and not only the data is extraordinary, but the concept is extraordinary. So I think we are dealing with something that is just larger than just what it does against HER2-positive tumors. The concept is a smart one. It's basically, since HER2 overexpression occurs only in tumors and not in normal tissues, we have a therapeutic opportunity to attach to trastuzumab a very potent toxin with the goal of having that toxin be delivered only to the cancer cells that express HER2 and that preserves and does not attack, if you wish, normal HER2 expressing cells in the body. So then the idea is an antimetabolite, it's a vinc alkaloid, mycentin, very, very potent. It has 10,000 times the potency of vinorelbine. This is a lethal thing. You could not give that to a person.
I heard they tried doing that.
They tried, and it was a non-starter. I mean, it's not doable. It's so potent. And now they attach this thing via a linker to trastuzumab. So here trastuzumab is being used, you see, as a delivery capsule. It's not being thought as an anti-HER2 therapy. It's just a carrier. Goes into the cell, the antibody trastuzumab TDM1, in this case, binds to the receptor. The whole complex becomes internalized because that's what happens. When an antibody binds a receptor, the whole thing gets internalized. And then inside the cell, the very potent cytotoxic load gets relieved. And then it just kills the cell. So very appealing, very selective. And what we have seen is absolutely striking clinical data. In the Emilia study, we compared it to the combination of second-line lapatinib and capecitabine. It's far superior. It has less side effects. So in a way, it's a very appealing concept. The big debate for everybody is, what are we going to do in our clinic when we have trastuzumab and we have pertuzumab and T-DM1 and lapatinib? How do we put this together? What do we need to do? And some people are excited and they are willing to start T-DM1 from the beginning. And other people say, no, wait. And so we are in a situation that we were never before, in which we are not going to know what to do, because the number of options that we have are going to be so vast that it's going to be complicated. I think this is a moment to keep the calm, intellectual calm, if you wish, and go step by step. The data in T-DM1 that we have, the Emilia study, is in the second line setting. And that's where it has been proven to be so superior to the approved therapy in that indication. In the first-line setting, we have trastuzumab and pertuzumab plus docetaxel. People say that it is more toxic than T-DM1 by indirect comparison. This may be true, but remember, docetaxel is only given a median of 6 cycles. And after you're done with docetaxel in the first-line setting, you have many, many months. The median time to progression-free survival is 18 months, I believe, in the combination of pertuzumab and trastuzumab. So you have patients that can be for many, many months basically devoid of any side effect because pertuzumab and trastuzumab has no side effects whatsoever when given without the chemotherapy part. So in my mind, the way I see it, all this is that at this moment, I would use pertuzumab with trastuzumab in the first-line setting, and I would wait until progression to apply T-DM1. Now, all this may change, of course, and Marianne, which is an ongoing phase 3 study in the first-line setting, may change all this, right? Because we have an arm that is very exciting, which is combining T-DM1 with pertuzumab without chemo. And by the way, that could be the winning arm on that study.
That's where my money is.
Yeah, so imagine. So then we could be in a situation in which we would have a chemotherapy devoid first-line therapy for metastatic HER2-positive disease.
I guess we ought to say, too, here that the three arms of the trial are trastuzumab chemo, T-DM1 alone, and T-DM1 with pertuzumab. Any guess when we might see the answer?
I think the study is fully accrued. I don't know. I think it's going to be at least a year just because these patients do so well.
So getting back to this algorithm, I should have clarified before when you're talking about first-line therapy because Memorial, you all had a paper at San Antonio looking at paclitaxel with pertuzumab, trastuzumab. Which taxane do you tend to utilize? Do you hear people being able to get reimbursed for paclitaxel?
They do. They do. I think it's totally superimposable. At Memorial, we use paclitaxel, but I think they're totally superimposable. And I think that's basically come down to patients and physicians' preference. I cannot see a difference.
So getting back to the issue of first-line therapy, 85-year-old lady you'd never want to give chemo to who has metastatic HER2-positive disease.
And I'm assuming is ER-negative.
ER negative, right?
So I still think today that weekly paclitaxel to this patient with pertuzumab and trastuzumab is an excellent choice. You can modulate the dose of the chemotherapy. HER2 positive disease is a lethal disease. I mean, very aggressive. So I would have no problem in principle in weekly paclitaxel plus pertuzumab and trastuzumab in that setting.
How about if I said, how about T-DM1 in that same patient?
I'll tell to you, sure, but I have no data on, you know, I have a combination that at 30 months of follow-up has not yet reached its survival. I have a combination in which after a few weeks of chemotherapy, I can remove the chemo and I can leave that patient, 85 years old, without chemotherapy for many, many months. And T-DM1 clearly has less side effects than chemotherapy, no question, but it also has side effects. And it is less clear for how long you can give it. So I don't have experience of 30 months on T-DM1, but I do have experience on 30 months on pertuzumab and trastuzumab. So I'm not trying to, I like T-DM1 a lot, and it's a fantastic addition. But I think we need to be respectful of the data. And so I would feel inclined to have pertuzumab in this case.
As usual, I'm just trying to act as a vessel through which, you know, oncologists can ask these questions that are coming up. And definitely another one is, as you mentioned, it's awful tempting to think about T-DM1 and pertuzumab. Could you envision yourself attempting to utilize that outside a trial right now?
I would not. Definitely not. We don't know enough about the safety. We don't know enough about the efficacy of the combination. We have some indication that this is a very active combination when it comes to response rate. There's no question about that. But I don't know the long-term efficacy, and I don't understand yet the overall strategy in the therapy of the disease. We are in a situation in which we are not curing the patient. We just have to strategize on what steps are we going to take. The approach that gets you the best survival has been the wise use of therapies in a sequential fashion. This is my memorial hat here, my Larry Norton training coming to surface. But it is what it is, but it's true. It's true. So unless there is a tremendous synergy between T-DM1 and pertuzumab, which I don't know at this point, I think we are better served in maximizing and optimizing one line of therapy, and then upon progression, then go in with the other approach. You could make the argument that why don't you start on T-DM1 and then switch to trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and I think that's a very valid argument, and I think that would be something for discussion, and my guess is that down the line, that's what people will do, and people will just change the order of things in a way that would be based on multiple factors.
What about trials of T-DM1 in the neoadjuvant, post-neoadjuvant, and adjuvant setting? What's going on? What's being discussed?
Right. So there is a lot of activity in the neoadjuvant setting. So there are a number of trials that are being designed and are ready to start. So there's a very complex trial with 6 arms that I cannot even remember, but is addressing all the potential combinations. Then you have more focused trials trying to look for a biomarker. So I think that's something that we will do and that we will get nice answers. There is one setting that is very appealing, and that's a study that I believe will be chaired by NSIBP. And this is a randomization in patients after neoadjuvant therapy that have not achieved pathological complete remission. So that's a very smart concept. So basically, we know that in the HER2-positive setting, if you do not achieve a complete pathological remission, you have a significant chance of having disease recurrence. So the trial is as follows. These are patients that receive trastuzumab-based therapy in the neoadjuvant setting, and then they go to surgery. And those that do not achieve a PCR, then they are randomized to continue standard therapy with trastuzumab or to receive instead T-DM1. I think that's a very smart design. That trial, in my mind, is likely to be positive because you are identifying a patient population that has shown some form of partial resistance to HER2, and it's just beautiful, conceptually elegant, and, I mean, chapeau, you know. When you saw the design, you say, great, these guys are fantastic. The other thing is the adjuvant study, and we are ready to go with that one. So we have a very pragmatic adjuvant study. It's going to be similar to Affinity, but one arm, we're going to be assuming that pertuzumab and trastuzumab is going to be the winning combination on the current pertuzumab trial. So we are assuming that pertuzumab will be better than just trastuzumab alone. And then the 2 study arms, one will be trastuzumab and pertuzumab, and the other will be pertuzumab and T-DM1. And we're launching that.
Pertuzumab and T-DM1.
So it's chemotherapy?
Without any other chemo?
No. The ACT.
Same time?
So you start with the AC.
Right.
Then you go with paclitaxel. And then when you finish the paclitaxel, that's when you start with T-DM1.
Wow. Interesting. That one ought to accrue really fast. Let's talk a little bit about mTOR inhibitors, the Bolero efforts and your work in that. And maybe you can summarize a little bit about, again, what we've learned over the last couple of years about that strategy and particularly your clinical experience using everolimus.
Right. So there is strong evidence that the mTOR pathway mediates resistance to anti-estrogen therapy. The evidence in the lab is striking. It's very, very strong evidence. So based on that, we started a number of clinical trials combining mTOR inhibitors, in this case everolimus, with AIs. And it's a long number of trials. We did a neoadjuvant study, randomized phase 2, that showed the superiority of everolimus plus letrozole. And then we embarked on the Bolero 2 study. That's the registration phase 3 study in patients with advanced ER-positive breast cancer that had progressed prior to starting this therapy to either letrozole or to anastrozole. So this is a study that had 700 patients, about 700 patients, and we randomized them 2-to-1 2-hexamethine plus everolimus versus hexamethine and placebo. The primary study endpoint was progression-free survival, and then we also had, as part of the study endpoint, overall survival and biomarkers. And what we observed in that study was a very profound improvement in progression-free survival. So the hazard ratio was 0.43. We went from 4 months to 10.6 months. I think this is practice changing, basically, and it adds now clearly a new line of therapy in these patients that, on the other hand, they don't respond well to chemotherapy. So I think that's extremely exciting. The good news is that we have tumor material on almost every single patient, and we have now sequenced those specimens, all of them, using a Foundation Medicine-based approach. So we are going to be able to characterize the genomics underlying who benefits from mTOR or not.
Do you envision that we are, in the near future, in general, not just related to your presentation, actually going to be in a situation where clinically we are going to be deciding whether or not to use, for example, everolimus based on some type of assay?
I have no question in my mind. This will apply to everolimus. This will apply to PI3 kinase inhibitors. This will apply to pertuzumab. And by the way, this will apply to chemo and will apply to hormonal therapy. The complexity is such of this that our minds will not be able to even remember what we need to do. So we will need help. And our bet at Sloan Kettering, our bet is that we need to partner with artificial intelligence platforms. And so, you know, just to let you know what we're doing, we have partnered with IBM and with Watson. And what we see clearly in the clinic is that we're going to have some system, some computer-based system that will have to lay out to us the different options based on the mutational profile of our tumors. So in the case of Bolero, I will not tell you the data in detail, but I will tell you that we have found what would be the classical mutations or the classical amplifications that you would expect. So we have a high proportion of PI3 kinase mutations. As I said, it's close to 40% mutations in PI3 kinase. We're going to have cyclin D1 amplifications. We're going to have mutations of the ER itself. We're going to have FGFR amplifications. So we're going to have about 20 or 30 genomic alterations that will define, no question, they will define how these tumors respond to the therapy that we're giving them.
Could you maybe make an estimate in terms of what fraction of ER-positive disease we'll end up treating with everolimus?
I don't know. That I couldn't tell, because it's not going to be a clear answer, because it depends on so many parameters. So let's imagine for a second that the PI3 kinase alpha mutation predicts not resistance to everolimus, but that predicts a better response to the PI3 kinase inhibitors. So you see, it's not going to be just based on the outcome that you're going to have to a particular therapy,
right,
but it's also going to be based on what other options do you have in that exactly same case.
But I guess maybe I missed this. Does everolimus work on the PI3 kinase mutation tumors?
That's what we don't know. That's what the data of Bolero will tell us.
Interesting. There's been a lot of concern about the tolerability, the side effects with everolimus. I hear a lot of people concerned about using it. Mucositis, they're concerned about pneumonitis. Can you talk about the practical issues involved in these and other side effect issues?
So this is a very important question. Everolimus is not hormonal therapy. It's not chemo, but it's not hormonal therapy, and it does have side effects. And they're different. They're different than chemotherapy. To me, the biggest of all is mucositis, and in particular, because once a patient develops grade 3 mucositis, that's the mucositis that does not allow them to eat well or to drink, that mucositis stays on for a long time. So the patients are stuck with mucositis, and sometimes they have to be admitted to the hospital. So it's not like febrile neutropenia, if you wish, in which you recover quickly sometimes. So the goal here is to prevent at any cost grade 3 mucositis. The differential factor of mucositis induced by mTOR is that it occurs very early. So it occurs almost always within the first 4 weeks. So in my clinic, in my practice, what I do is that when I start a patient on everolimus, I tell them to come back for the first 2 weeks. Short visit, I just see them, but I get a sense. Because if they develop grade 2 and you stop until it resolves, until grade 1 or less, then you're fine. Patient is fine, and then you can start at the same dose level, and you are okay. That's one point. The other point is that the mucositis induced by everolimus is different from the one that we are used to see with chemotherapy. These are well-formed ulcers, small, some of them. They are in unusual sides of the mouth. You have to look. They are under the gingiva. They are in the back of the tongue. So you have to really make an effort to have a thorough exam of the oral cavity. And then the patients have the tendency of underplay the pain that they have. You have to ask them, is this painful? Do you feel it? If they feel it and it's painful, even a little bit, that's great too. You stop and then you start again. I think that by doing that, you're fine and that you progress. Pneumonitis is much less frequent. In the case of pneumonitis, what we recommend is just good clinical judgment. If patients are a little bit short of breath, then, you know, we should have a very little threshold to do this, to stop or to look at by CAT scan mostly. But again, less frequent, reversible. And I think in the case of pneumonitis, I just use good clinical judgment. If they are a little bit more short of breath and they should not be, then that's a reason for us to look.
So that's your main screening tool, is looking for shortness of breath, no imaging?
No.
And I think it was Hope Rugo who I think mentioned to me the thought that maybe the mucositis is potentially viral.
We don't know. Or fungal. We don't know. The people that propose that this could be viral and it could be true is that it takes a long time to recover.
So that's
the rationale, right? I mean, then the other thing that we have to realize is that mTOR inhibitors are immunosuppressants.
Right.
They are using kidney transplants. So one conceivably could imagine that we are applying some sort of immune suppression to these patients. But I don't think that has been shown. I think it's a possibility, but there's no proof that that's the case.
I've heard Joyce O'Shaughnessy talk about some kind of corticosteroid mouthwash.
Yeah.
Do you believe in that?
People do it. We don't have any data to support it. I think an active hygiene of the mouth by multiple means clearly recommended, but I don't think we have data that steroids or non-steroids are superior.